The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
All right, well, I hope y'all are enjoying the food. My name is Kelly McClanahan. I am the International President of the National Security and Law Society. And I just want to thank y'all for coming out on a Friday to enjoy our little conference here. I have the great honor today of introducing a well-known figure in the field and a good friend of mine, Suzanne Spaulding. Suzanne has done pretty much everything that those of us who are students want to do. She has been the Minority Staff Director of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. She's been the Deputy Staff Director and General Counsel of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, Assistant General Counsel of the CIA. I mean, she's done two things for the ABA that were the American Bar Association. She was on the President's Task Force on Enemy Combatants, and she was the chair of the ABA Standing Committee on Law and National Security. And it's actually through that I met Suzanne. That committee has been very, very helpful to NSLS for the past couple years, and we have greatly enjoyed working with them. They do lots of very good events that have kind of inspired our events. They actually have one coming up next month. I'm not sure what day it is, but you can find it on the website of the ABA. Anyway, Suzanne has spoken as an expert on all sorts of topics, and today she's going to share with us her thoughts for the current and upcoming lawyers in this field. And without further ado, I just want to introduce Suzanne Spaulding and turn the mic over to her. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm pleased to be here. Mark called me day before yesterday to say, you know, the keynote speaker had fallen through and could I pinch hit? So with that caveat, that's my excuse, I'm pinch hitting. I'm going to try to keep my remarks brief. I always say that I'm never as successful as I hope. But I'm going to sort of maybe throw out and maybe sort of shorthand a lot of issues in the hopes that we'll have some time before you have to break, before your next panel, to have some discussion and some dialogue. Because these are issues, I mean, this is a very interesting time in the intelligence community, and there are issues about which there ought to be a lot of informed public discussion and debate, and so I hope we'll have some of that today. I did think it was appropriate, you know, that we're doing this on the anniversary of the establishment of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, and there's been a fair amount written in the last few days, but I would particularly commend to your attention, if you haven't seen it already, David Ignatius's piece, I think it's in the Washington Post today, entitled Fix the Intelligence Mess. I think he's right on in terms of his diagnosis of where we are today, which is really scary. It really is frightening. His last line of his op-ed is, "This is a dangerous situation for the country, and it needs to be fixed now." And sadly, that is consistent with both what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing from folks in the intelligence community. The question is, you know, twofold. First of all, you know, how did we get here, and what should we do about it at this stage? There are a lot of folks who think that a big part of the problem was simply the creation of the DNI, that was a bad idea from the get-go. I'm not one of those. I actually was a supporter of the idea and am a supporter of the concept of having a Director of National Intelligence for a variety of reasons. And when I was on the House Intelligence Committee back in 2003, we did a careful look at this. In fact, this goes back to when I was on the Senate Intelligence Committee back in 96. When the Aspen-Brown Commission was doing its look at the roles and missions of the intelligence community, and the Senate Intelligence Committee decided to do its own review. And we reached very similar conclusions to this notion of a Director of National Intelligence. The Aspen-Brown Commission did not recommend the establishment of a Director of National Intelligence. I have to say, I think that is in part because the Aspen-Brown Commission was chaired by first Les Aspin, and then he passed away, and then Harold Brown, both former Secretaries of Defense. I think to this day, particularly this Secretary of Defense, but every Secretary of Defense has resisted this notion of a Director of National Intelligence. But at any rate, I want to sort of get issues out, and then we can go into greater detail to the extent that any of you are interested in the question and answer period. But I actually think the concept of a director of national intelligence who is separate from the CIA and therefore can be viewed as an honest broker and also has the time and the wherewithal to focus on the community and doesn't, you know, become simply focused on that which the DCI could control, which was simply the CIA. So that there was a twofold problem there with trying to combine those tasks. And I think the DNI concept, for those reasons alone, made a lot of sense, pulling it out from the CIA. Once you pulled the DNI out from CIA, you have to figure out how do you then empower that individual? You don't have one individual who on their own is going to manage this community. And you know, we're hearing a lot in the last few days about this report that indicates the budget is, you know, five times the size of the community staff's budget. The staff size is, you know, three times the community management staff. We tend to reach for those things that we can measure objectively. So staff size and budget numbers are something we can reach for and say, you know, clearly indicate we've got a failure here. And frankly, I think that's not a bad start. I think it, in fact, should have been leaner and meaner. And I think what it reflects, though, is an effort to make up for a lack of political will. The problem with the DNI is not in the legislation, though the legislation is not perfect. The legislation is good enough. Frankly, I'm one of those who felt that the authorities of the DCI, while far from perfect, were good enough. If you have the political will, if you have the president behind you 100%, and ideally if you've got the SecDef on board, although that has almost always been too much to hope for, but at a minimum, you've really got to have a commitment from the president to stand behind you as you begin to break all of those rice bowls in the community, which absolutely is what has to happen. So I think that the DNI has the authority, and I think that's the biggest problem, and that is not going to be fixed by tweaking the legislation. In terms of what the DNI could do and should do, my sense has always been that the first thing the DNI should have done, most important thing, is getting your arms around the budget. DCI always did budget build, although it was usually just stapling the budgets of the various agencies together and handing them in. And the DNI needs to be much more involved in the budget build. But more important than that, to my mind, is the year of execution. It's watching in as close to real time as you can how that money is being spent. That's the way that you begin to get a sense of how your resources are deployed. Trying to go at it from asking everybody to tell you how their resources are deployed is, you know, in terms of how many analysts you have and all that, that's all well and good. But the way you really get at the way to control the community is to understand inside and out that budget during the year of execution. Require that they build in greater transparency. That's never been there. It's still not there. But that's how you figure out where all your resources are deployed in a close to real-time basis. And that allows you to then more effectively, I think, assess and evaluate the effectiveness of that deployment and to redeploy as you need to during the year. I mean, one of the big challenges for the DCI, though we had reprogramming authority, I would have shifted the burden of proof and, you know, played with it a bit. The biggest problem was that the DCI didn't know where the money was. When a new priority would come up, the ability to look and see that a program is not spending, that there's a pocket of money here, the ability to that you can reach out and move to something more important, the ability to say you, program director, are not on board, you're not getting it, you know, we've repeatedly tried to get and you're not on board, and therefore I'm taking your money and I'm moving it to somebody who gets it and who is on board. That's how you assert authority. So I think the budget's the most important thing. I still think we need Goldwater Nichols for the intelligence community. I don't think this legislation did it, but as I say, I think that there's enough in there that a powerful DNI could make that happen, but we need that greater unity of effort. We need the heads of the agencies to be more like the service chiefs under Goldwater Nichols, hire, train, and equip, make sure that the intelligence professionals are sitting at their desk at the start of the day, you know, trained and with all of the tools they need to get their job done, but the head of the agency isn't the one who tells them what their priority is that day or isn't the one who decides what their priority is that day. It's the DNI. It's the combatant commander. If you set up centers like the Proliferation Center and the Counterterrorism Center, those are your combatant commanders. They should control the operational activity of those troops in the intelligence community and empower, and the agency heads then are there to empower and facilitate and enable those intelligence professionals who want to do, you know, the best job, to do the best job. I think we need to bring greater integrity back into the process, and the legislation did a number of things to try to accomplish that. I think one of the ways you do that is you bring additional customers into the process, and I think Congress needs to be taken more seriously as a customer of intelligence. One of the things that analysts have told me is they are, all of their time is consumed answering questions. They are no longer encouraged or in some cases even permitted to suggest what the questions should be. And that is so critical for strategic, over the horizon kind of thinking and intelligence work, to be able to tell policymakers not just answer their immediate questions, but what are the questions they should be asking. And that has been really stifled and discouraged and, as I say, in some cases, really not allowed. And I think broadening your customer base to include Congress will get a greater variety of questions being asked, which is going to give you a greater variety of analytic product out there and thinking. Promotion policies, I think, still need to be looked at. They create real dysfunctional incentives in the intelligence community, and one of them goes directly to this integrity issue. For analysts, they are promoted based on customer satisfaction in large part. And I know senior analysts who were told, if you want to be SES, if you want to get that GS-15, you need to be have customers asking for you by name. Well, customers aren't going to ask for you by name if you're bringing them bad news, if you're saying things that are inconvenient for them. And that has a real, I mean, that has a real impact. And I think it's something that needs to be seriously looked at. In the DO, we've known for a long time that promotion, even though we've tried to rewrite the criteria and change this, it always comes down to how many recruitments do you have? Did you get a recruitment? And to my mind, that's been the greatest stumbling block to our efforts to increase our stable of terrorist assets. It's not the human rights guidelines. It's not a risk-averse culture, except to the extent that it's really, really hard to recruit a terrorist, to get into those. And if you are a young case officer with a 2 or 3 year rotation in a location, and you're trying to figure out, you know, you want to make a recruitment, you've got to have a recruitment under your belt. So are you going to go after the easy target, or are you going to go after the really hard one that isn't likely to pan out and that is, by the way, dangerous? I mean, so I think, you know, we need to look at promotion policies and ways in which, and I one suggestion that I would make to the DNI, I would establish something like a Speaking Truth to Power Award. I mean, when I talk to my friends in the intelligence community at senior levels in management, you know, they swear that they tell their people over and over again, we just want you to tell the truth. Just tell it like it is. You know, we will stand behind you, et cetera, et cetera. And yet the message isn't getting through. That is not the message that particularly, as I say, that the analysts carry with them when they go into these policy briefings. Now, not across the board, and a lot of them do show, you know, terrific courage and integrity and do, in fact, tell it like it is, but there is this pervasive sense, and I think, you know, something dramatic that really rewards people for saying inconvenient things to policymakers would go a long way toward trying to restore some of the credibility and integrity. Big issue always about the role of DOD in intelligence, and I share the concerns of a lot of people that DOD is basically creating, replicating the intelligence community within DOD, and which really just means replicating CIA within DOD because they already have all of the collection agencies, all of the technical collection agencies. And I think it is a cause for concern for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that CIA is becoming increasingly irrelevant. And, you know, my own thought on this is I think there may be some value at this stage in what I call it blowing up CIA, in tearing it apart and taking the analysts and moving them over to be under the DNI and having what's left be the clandestine service. And really focus on human. The analysts then, all of the analysts under the DNI, should rotate through operational support as operational support analysts. The operators really need that close connection with the analytic community. But you don't want your operational support analysts also responsible for strategic intelligence. One, because they get squeezed out. And so what we wind up with is no strategic intelligence because they're caught up with the tactical operational support intelligence. And two, there is a risk they get co-opted. I mean, I saw this. I was at CIA for 6 years. And the analysts that are sitting there with the operators day in and day out want that operation to be successful. And it begins to, you know, there's a real risk that begins to color their analytic assessments about how successful the operation has been. So I think you rotate them through, but I think that's one of the ways. And then I want to get to authorities because the issue of DOD and its role in intelligence, I think, is closely connected to what sorts of authorities do we need to have in place and do we want to have in place and the kind of public discussion and debate we need to have. I think DOD's intelligence efforts overseas create potential concerns in terms of coordination with what CIA is doing. But I think more broadly, we have a whole framework set up, a legal framework set up, an oversight framework set up, that I think is getting bypassed when it comes to DOD's role in intelligence overseas, and particularly, I think, with respect to covert actions. Covert action, as you know, is defined as an attempt to change a situation overseas, to influence a government or the facts on the ground overseas in which the hand of the U.S. government is not to be revealed, is to be hidden. Exempt from the definition of covert action in the National Security Act is traditional military activities. One of the legal implications of the global war on terrorism is that anything DOD does with respect to counterterrorism is now a traditional military activity. Therefore, nothing DOD does is considered a covert action. And I don't think that's what was envisioned. When the statute was written, it doesn't say by CIA. It says by anybody in the government. And there is a careful legal framework for approving and monitoring and doing oversight of covert actions that isn't in place with respect to the activities of DOD overseas in the global war on terrorism. DOD's role in domestic intelligence collection. I'm always amazed when people, you know, sort of get all touchy about the idea of an MI5 type or a domestic intelligence collection agency inside the United States. Oh, my God, we can't have a domestic intelligence collection inside the United States. We have three, at least, domestic intelligence collection agencies inside the United States, DOD, CIA, and FBI. They're all engaged in intelligence collection inside the United States. What we don't have is a robust and informed public discussion and debate about what do we want these folks to be doing inside the United States? How do we want to address the nature of the threat inside this country with these assets and what they can bring to bear? And what are the appropriate safeguards that we want to put in place? And how are we going to effectuate, you know, effective oversight? I worry in the authorities realm about criminal authorities that migrate into the intelligence world without a sufficient understanding of the difference between those two worlds. And I see this on the Hill all the time with the authorities that have moved from the criminal context into FISA. And they changed the standard. For example, let's look at the famous library provision, Section 215, which is referred to more neutrally as the business records provision, but which in fact is a provision that allows the government to compel you to hand over any tangible item, anybody to hand over any tangible item, so long as it is relevant to an investigation to protect against international terrorism. The argument is made that we've had this authority in the criminal context forever to get a subpoena. That standard is relevant to a criminal investigation. A criminal investigation means it is related to a crime. Under our Constitution, a crime has to be very specifically defined so that Americans, anybody, knows whether they are committing a crime. The idea is you have to be given sufficient notice that you don't make any mistakes about whether you are or are not on the right side of that line. The standard in the intel, when it migrates over then into FISA, the standard is relevant to an investigation to protect against international terrorist activities. not even relevant to an investigation of terrorist activities, which at least terrorist activities are a crime, and you know, you could argue by that it's bound by the definition in the criminal statutes of terrorist activities. This is like an investigation to protect against bank robbery. I mean, it's just stop and think about what are the kinds of things you might do to protect against. Now, certainly you might investigate everybody in a neighborhood. I mean, you know, it really is a very, very broad standard. The reality is intelligence investigations are very broad by their nature. That's the nature of intelligence collection. That is a key difference between criminal investigations, which are focused on a particular crime or criminal activity, and they want to find out who committed that crime. And they really don't want to be distracted by potential John Doe 2s or John Doe 3s or anything else, because that just muddies the water for the jury. They really want to be focused, laser-like, find out who did this crime. Intelligence investigations are very wide-ranging. Anything might be relevant. What, there might be a John Doe 2? You know, we're going to send off some assets to figure out that piece and, you know, whatever. And that's a reference to the Oklahoma City bombing at any rate. And they're very different. And that's, I mean, I'll leave it at that. I mean, I think that's the point, is that we need to be thoughtful about that. We need to figure out, given that difference, and given that we don't have the safeguards that are inherent in knowing that you're going to go to court with a prosecution, and that, you know, if you do something illegal or abusive, that you won't be able to introduce it in court, all those things ought to be thought about as we try to apply these authorities in the domestic intelligence collection. We need a sustainable legal framework that comes about as a result of informed public discussion and debate. And I'll just give you sort of my bottom line on the NSA eavesdropping, and then if we want to engage in that, we certainly can do that. My view on the NSA eavesdropping is that, as we were talking about earlier, I don't buy the argument that the authorization for the use of military force was a specific statutory authority that overcomes the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act requirements. There are a number of reasons for that. You know, basically, the FISA is such an extensive and comprehensive statute that the courts typically will not allow something like that to be overridden by a subsequent statute that is as general as the authorization for the use of military force. And I think that is bolstered, obviously, by the provision in FISA that talks about what the situation will be in the event of a declaration of war, that you get 15 days where you can ignore FISA and do whatever you need to do. And as we learn from legislative history, the idea is then you would come into Congress and seek to have it amended to cover whatever you think you need to cover. So that takes us out of Category 1 of Justice Jackson's famous concurring opinion in the Steele seizure case, in which he says, you know, that when the president is acting consistent with and concurrent with congressional direction, the president is at his strongest. And that's a powerful president. That's a strong, powerful president, is one who is acting in conjunction with Congress. There's a gray area where Congress hasn't spoken, and then there's Category 3 where Congress has spoken and the president wants to act in a way that is inconsistent with what Congress has said. And I think that's where we are in this case. And there, Justice Jackson said, the president's authority is at its weakest. That's where the president is weakest. So this notion that somehow this is a strong president, this is makes the president stronger, I think misses the boat. This is, in fact, where the president is weakest. But it does say that the president has no authority. So we're left in that, you know, sort of figuring out what is the president's inherent constitutional authority. What Jackson says is to find that the president has authority when he's acting in conflict with what Congress has said, you have to find that he has not just inherent but exclusive authority. The Congress has no constitutional authority to weigh in on this issue. Just to say Congress has no constitutional authority potentially to weigh in, which I think the administration, you know, has sort of not quite gone that far, to weigh in on regulating electronic surveillance inside the United States. I do think there is an argument, there's a very reasonable argument, that in the event of a crisis situation where circumstances come up that are unforeseen, were unforeseen by Congress when it drafted the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and, you know, could not have been foreseen, and there is an emergency, that the president can go ahead and act and say, go ahead and do this electronic surveillance. But at the same time, the president should send the folks down to the Hill to say, to work with Congress, to amend the statute, to put this on a more solid legal footing. And I think it withstands a Fourth Amendment analysis. I mean, you have to look at the nature of the privacy intrusion, but you balance that against the government's need. My view is that the government's need is strongest at that moment, when there isn't time to go first to Congress. But that after a while, over time, that need dissipates as there is time to go to Congress. And 4 years later, I think it's a pretty weak argument. So I'll leave it at that so that we have some time for questions and answers. We got some questions? Yeah.
Given your construct of appropriate roles for the defense intelligence agencies, both domestic and international, do you believe that the domestic electronic activities of NSA should be moved into a new agency?
It's not clear to me that this is an issue that resolves itself by changing the boxes or, rearranging the wiring diagram. I go back and forth on whether we ought to have a separate domestic intelligence collection agency. And certainly a subset of that would be, if you do, should those domestic activities of NSA move into it? It seems to me that it's not a practical solution because the same technology is used, the same resources are used, as far as I can tell, for both international, overseas, purely overseas, and international touching the U.S., and then the FISA covered purely domestic. With respect to whether we ought to have a separate domestic intelligence collection agency, I think I see some real advantages from the standpoint of clearly getting our arms around a legal framework for domestic intelligence collection versus criminal investigations and, having that line be much clearer. I think there's some real advantages there and some potential protections for civil liberties inherent in it. My biggest fear is that I hope we won't always have this level of threat inside the United States and this, high a need for domestic intelligence collection, and yet these agencies, once they're created, never go away. So then you've got an agency looking for a mission.
Until recently, the fact that most of the electronic surveillance capabilities of any note were reposing within NSA and DoD function was not particularly troubling. But now, given the targets of surveillance and intelligence gathering and so on, much more of the center of gravity shifting from CONUS to domestic, it seems that there is a fair argument that we need a properly authorized, lawfully, and properly judicially overseen domestic electronic intelligence gathering capability.
I mean, I can see the argument. I'm not yet persuaded, but yeah.
Suzanne, I'd like your assessment on the existence or lack thereof of legitimate oversight of the intelligence community. Recently, there was either a GAO or CRS report, I think it was GAO, about transfer sharing of information between the intel community. The DNI refused to cooperate and said that they had no oversight over anything that he was doing. Even though we had the last two CIA directors coming both from the HPSC, staff director and as member, you still have the CIA essentially saying to many of Congress that we're not going to share with you certain information. The NSA surveillance case, argument was we're only going to give the Big Eight or whatever the number was, we're not going to give it to the rest of the oversight on either the Senate or the House. And in experiences that I've had with both HPSC and CISI, some of our concerns have always been many of the staffers and counsel are detailees from the agencies. The very agencies we're trying to bring our clients to or ourselves to raise concerns about with respect to certain conduct. And as you know, just as prevalent here in Washington. So the intel community, even though I guess Mayor Pompeo now says it was about 100,000 people, is a very small community. And everybody knows one another for the most part here in D.C. And we used to go over to the oversight committees and say, we think such and such person has done something wrong. And the staffer response would be, well, I've known that person for 22 years. I've worked with them. I can't imagine they would ever do anything wrong. I guess this meeting is over. We're going to walk on by. Where's the oversight? I don't know if you heard from the first panel, we were talking about judicial oversight on some intel matters and saying we didn't think that existed. I don't see it from the Congress either. It leaves you with an executive unchecked. I'd like to comment on that.
First of all, Tenet was from the Senate Intelligence Committee, not HPSC. And I don't think there are detailees on the committees. There are people who, I mean, they are populated largely with people who were just in the intelligence community, and often they're given responsibility, oversight responsibility for the very agency or department or entity that they just left. So I think, you know, some of those concerns are valid, but I don't think the intelligence committees allow detailees. I do think oversight has been sorely lacking. I think it has not been adequate, and it's a critical issue because it goes right to the core of how you have a secret intelligence collection capability residing comfortably in a democracy. And you cannot do that without credible, effective oversight. It is absolutely fundamental because there will inevitably be things that come up. And you need to have members that can't be shared with the public, but that, you know, part of it gets out into the press and there's a scandal. You need to have credible members of Congress who can come before the American public and say, either, you know, I know I've been following this, I know all about it, and I'm here to tell you it's not as bad as you think. Or, I've been following this, I know all about it, and we're very aware of the problems, and we are, you know, working hard to address them. And frankly, I just don't think you have that today. You don't have that kind of credibility. I think the Gang of Eight briefings are very troubling, and I've written about that. The National Security Act makes it, I think, very clear that they are to be used in exceptional circumstances only and only with regard to covert actions. My sense is that they have been used a lot more broadly than that, and certainly unless there's significant information about this eavesdropping, that we don't know about, that is not a covert action, and yet it was limited to the Gang of Eight. And I agree with Jane Harmon on this, that I think that is inconsistent with the letter and the spirit of the National Security Act. And from a practical standpoint, it just simply makes effective oversight impossible. The members walk in, they can't be expected to walk in with all of the institutional knowledge and background and familiarity with the nuances of the law and all of the practical implications into these briefings with the vice president, you know, bringing them into the club and know all the questions they need to ask and all of the potential pitfalls and problems and concerns that they should be thinking about as they hear this briefing. They have no staff with them to help, and they can't talk to the staff at any point ever to help them figure that out. And how are they to do ongoing, even if they fully understood it and, you know, got everything about it, how do they conduct ongoing oversight of something like this? I mean, are they supposed to troop down to the agencies and, you know, have these meetings and ask all the questions? And I mean, it's really so ineffective. And I think there are ways you could fix it. I think you can maintain the Gang of Eight briefings for covert actions, and I think you should allow members to bring one staff person. And I think you ought to have a written record of the briefing that is shared with all the participants of the meeting. If it has to be stored in the executive branch only, that's okay. But at least have a written record of it. And I think that would go a long way. I actually think the oversight subcommittees are a big help. When I first heard the recommendation, I think it was the 9/11 Commission recommended that the oversight committees have oversight subcommittees, I just laughed. I thought, you know, that doesn't make any sense to me. That's what the whole committee is supposed to be doing. But as I thought about it and talked to people, I began to see some wisdom in that if it's structured properly, because what happens is the committee inevitably, no matter what you do, is going to be pulled away by the scandal of the day. They spend all their time on the scandal of the day and on big ticket budget items. That's all that the members focus on the oversight committees right now. There is no, you know, effort to establish a strategic oversight plan at the beginning of the year or the beginning of a session or the beginning of a chair's term and stick to it, put staff on it, you know, decide what the priorities are, don't get distracted by the scandal of the day, really burrow in and figure out and be able to effectively assess and analyze what's going on in the intelligence community in those priority areas. And an oversight committee that was given that task and not pulled off for other things could be effective.
I was really intrigued by your Speaking Truth to Power Award, and I think that would be really interesting, but I'm kind of curious, if you had something like that, how would that not run the risk of creating kind of the opposite effect, so that, you know, only the people who give the inconvenient news are the ones that are recognized, and so people start going after red herrings and, you know, personal desire to get promoted?
I think that's a very low risk. there are so many countervailing pressures. I mean, the bottom line is people want to be, I mean, the analysts do want to be called in for brief. They want policymakers, not just the promotion, but they want policymakers to be calling them in to do the briefings. They want to get the kudos. Nobody wants to be the bearer of bad news over and over again. And, you get excluded from the meetings. I mean, I don't think it's a realistic fear. If you take one person a year or every 6 months or a quarter or however often you did it, I don't think you'd suddenly shift the balance of pressures in that.
I have a two-part question regarding both budget and also the BCR authorities. First, since you've been on both sides, both congressional and field, you might understand that part of the budgetary process is that end-of-year funds become often a slush fund for whoever happens to have those funds available.
Whoever can spend them fastest.
Who can spend fastest plus on priorities which may not necessarily right. Extend with the rest of the larger policy community. So with that being known, why is it Congress is not, the exception of a few RTD&E funding lines, which can be used over 2 years, which I think is a better formula in many cases, which can be converted for operation time as well. Why Congress hasn't taken a longer-term look at how to preclude the mad rush to essentially create this artificiality where these slush funds are created by necessity because they have to spend them.
Yeah.
Why haven't they gone these two-year funding lines more permanently? The second thing is BCI. I personally agree with George Tenet on an operation where he said that if we were doing this, we CIA or DCI, this would be considered covert action. So
I'm sorry, say that again.
He, when we were operating on an operation we were running in DOD, he said if we were doing this, this would be a covert action.
Yeah.
But you guys are doing it, you can do it.
Right.
So
who said that?
George Tenet.
George, okay.
DCI.
Okay.
So when he said that, he helped create circumstance which allowed this to develop in the 2000, I personally said about 2000, 2001 time. Along with that, on the contrary to that, I think what you're seeing now in DOD's creation of capability is a response to that very thing where often, as a DCI, because he owns CIA, he would go to them versus the DOD. Therefore, having someone who sat on both sides of the fence, it was almost out of necessity capability created because we couldn't get that support.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right. And I'll pick up on that last point first because I think it's important. I am not unsympathetic with DOD's incentives for creating its own capabilities. I mean, I have heard those stories too, where in Afghanistan, you know, where the CIA and DOD would be working really close, side by side on the ground, you know, getting great things done. And then one day, with no warning at all, CIA would suddenly say, you know, we've been pulled off. We got this is no longer our priority. We got to go do something else. And they're gone. And there's DOD without the capability. I think the problem there is who is establishing that priority? The head of CIA was able to say, this is no longer my priority. Nonsense. The DNI should be saying, what's the priority here? And if it's a priority for DOD to be there and DOD needs that capability, then it's a priority for CIA to provide them that support. I really think that goes to the core of the Goldwater-Nichols problem that I talked about earlier. It shouldn't be up to the head of CIA to decide what the national priority is for those resources. On the two-year funding issue, I think two-year funding or multi-year funding makes a lot of sense for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is planning. And even more significant, I think, is not having 90% of your budget in a supplemental, which is wreaks havoc with planning. And is a terrible idea for a lot of reasons. I worry about two-year funding as a way to address the large amount of funds at the end of the year is you'll just wind up with the same situation at the end of 2 years that you now wind up with at the end of 1 year. And I bet my solution to that problem goes back to what I said at the beginning about the DNI getting closer to real time or even quarterly would be an improvement, transparency into the execution of the budget. Because that allows you to identify this issue way earlier in the year. The problem is you don't identify it till the end of the year, and all of a sudden you got all these funds, and if you don't spend them, you lose them, and next year your budget is smaller. And I think the way to address that, as I say, is to have a earlier on be able to tell that you're not spending. And so where do we shift these funds to make them more productive, or how do we help this program or activity pick up its operational pace, tempo, or whatever is a better way to address it? Yeah.
I wanted to comment on a question on perspective of giving more power to the DNI to set the national priorities as opposed to the agency heads and moving to the national centers of excellence.
Yeah.
I'm looking small agency names, wear many hats. It's not just the utility businesses. Sometimes it's law enforcement. Sometimes it's administrative law. We have much larger portfolios than analysts of the larger agencies. We have to cover a lot more topics. And we have different strategic priorities because of the authority of some of our agencies. When you put all that power to DNI or one central head, you leave those small agency analysts much more susceptible to crisis control. We can't do the same kind of activities in both meeting after meeting after meeting when you can't actually keep the job.
Yeah.
So it is really a balance because if you think of Intel community, much of it is the biggest agencies out there. And the small agencies exist for a reason. They play a crucial role. And the more, I mean, there really is a tension there.
Yeah. Well, I think those are excellent points. And I do think that it's essential to distinguish between what might be most optimal for collection versus what you want to seek in analysis. And I think it's really important to preserve a multitude of perspectives and views and voices in the analytic community, that you don't make your effort to coordinate and deploy your resources effectively become you want everybody saying the same thing, or watered down analysis, or pull people out of their agencies. I mean, I think one of the reasons the DNI has ballooned in terms of staff is that the DNI doesn't have the authority to manage in any way folks in other agencies and only can manage the people he owns, just like the director of CIA was. And so he wants to own everybody. He thinks he needs to move everybody into his shop and into his building in order to be able to manage them. And I think it is just, as I say, indicative of the failure of the DNI to get to assert or to have the political will to make this successful. I think with respect to analysts, rotating analysts through again or assigning analysts to agencies is absolutely critical. They got to be at those daily policy meetings. They've got to support those agencies. In order to do that, they've got to understand their missions intimately. So I think it's a good point.
I want to thank you, Suzanne, for coming. Unfortunately, Ms. Balding does have to run to another engagement. So thank you very much. We enjoyed it. And for the rest of y'all, I hope you enjoyed your lunch. There's a little bit of stuff left over. We're going to be taking about a 10-minute break while C-SPAN breaks down their stuff. So go to the restroom, get some food. We'll start back up at around 1:05.